Let's move on to the passages on virtue. Passage 27 discusses kind of general rewards from being virtuous. Because you're a heedful person, you acquire wealth. Your good reputation gets spread around. You can enter a gathering of all kinds of people and do it confident and unabashed. In other words, you're not going to be afraid that someone's going to accuse you of some misbehavior as you walk into the assembly. Notice those two really have a lot to do with a sense of honor. You know, the honor that your good reputation and your ability to face groups of people without being abashed, based on the honor that comes from behaving virtuously. You die unconfused and you go to a good destination after death. Passage 28 talks in negative terms about, okay, the tendencies, if you break the precepts, these are the things that you tend to meet up with. Of course, if you maintain the precepts, then you protect yourself. You tend to protect yourself from these results. Taking life leads to a short lifespan. Stealing leads to loss of wealth. Illicit sex leads to rivalry and revenge. Telling lies leads to being falsely accused. Divisive speech leads to the breaking up of one's friendships. Harsh speech leads to, I love this one, unappealing sounds. When the big noise comes past, oh, that's the result of my harsh speech. Okay. Idle chatter leads to words that are not worth taking to heart. In other words, you just spill out words while other people just spill out words to you. So. And then finally, drinking alcohol leads to mental derangement. So you want to avoid those things, you observe those precepts. Again, these are tendencies, they're not ironclad connections. Passage 29 focuses on a point that I was making earlier about how the best way to work for someone's benefit is to get them to observe the precepts too. In other words, not just being nice to them, but you actually turn them into good agents. They're not just the recipients of your kindness, but you turn them into good agents to whatever extent you can. Any questions on any of those passages? Okay, in this case, because you are careful about your behavior, that's what heedfulness means. And you observing the precepts leads to heedfulness. And say that you have a business. The word gets around that the goods you sell are of good quality. You're a fair dealer. People want to do business with you. And having great wealth, okay, then if you use it well, then that goes even better, makes it even better. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Hi, John. I recall you said when you gave the retreat in France, they had a little trouble with the preceptor about alcohol.
Alcohol, yes.
Mm-hmm. How did you respond to it?
Okay, the first question was, this precept against alcohol, is it against all alcohol or just drinking to excess? And I said, I'm afraid it's all. So the next day, another question. And they numbered these. If you know French, the first one was, the second was vin deux. And the third one was vin trois, vin quatre, vin cinq. All these questions about vin. Okay. Second question was, okay, you have to understand here in France that if you offer someone a glass of wine and if someone offers you a glass of wine and you don't accept it, it's an insult. Therefore, this precept is going to have to be changed for France. Oh, we had a lot of clever people on that retreat. So I said, I'm pretty sure that even in France, that if you tell your friend that your doctor doesn't allow alcohol, then the friend would not be insulted. Now, traditionally, the Buddha is regarded as a doctor. So you don't have to tell which doctor, and you don't have to tell So you're not lying, right? Yes. And you don't have to tell what disease is being treated by this doctor. You just say that my doctor doesn't allow.
Yeah. Okay. The
disease of the human condition, yeah. Okay, that didn't stop them. The next day, on the table, fine camembert au point, crusty French bread just out of the oven, a bottle of pomade open and ready to pour. I consult my doctor. Would he recommend Coke Light? I had several answers to that one. First answer was the Buddha was not an American capitalist. He'd probably recommend San Pellegrino. Second answer was, why does friendship have to depend on wine? There was one more, but the one about they've discovered that wine has medicinal, it's good for preventing Alzheimer's, and I said, well, grape juice does just as well. So, there were a couple other clever questions. I was making the point the retreat was on the topic of mindfulness and karma, and so there were talks on mindfulness and talks on karma, and I was making the point that mindfulness is not what most people think it is. It's not bare awareness. It's not full awareness. It's a quality of your memory. You keep in mind certain things as you practice, and that's the mindfulness. So someone said, you know, when you lie, you have to remember who you told the lie to and which lie you told. Can we take lying to be a mindfulness practice? And I said, yes, but it would be practicing wrong mindfulness. Any other questions? Okay. About lying, the issue came up a while back about what would you do if you've got Jews in your attic and there are Nazis at the door. And there was a lot of discussion around this topic. And my response was, okay, you don't want to tell a lie even to the Nazis. Now, you don't have to tell them you have your Jews in the attic, but there are ways you can not get that information out without lying. I mean, you might say that I have nothing shameful in this house. Might be one response. You might say, check for yourself. Because when you're dealing with Nazis at the door, it's not the case, okay, you tell them a lie, and they say, okay, we'll go away. Some of them will say, we're going to come in and check regardless. So in a case like that, you don't want to have told a lie. And if they're not the case, the kind of ones, the ones who are just doing their job, but they don't want to bother your house, you can say pretty much anything. As long as it's true and you're not giving the information away, they'll go away. If they happen to be the first kind of Nazi, they take you out along with the Jews. If they're going to torture you, they're going to use that against you, the fact that you lied to them. So you want to be careful not to lie, even in cases like that. Someone was saying that the Theravadins hold to the precepts without any discernment, and actually holding to the precepts takes a lot of discernment, especially in cases like this. Someone comes up to you, have you seen my husband with another woman? Well, you have seen her husband with another woman. Why do you say so as not to get involved? I mean, if you want to get involved, you can, but if you decide I don't want to get involved in this case, what do you say? You got to think about that. One way might be to turn the question around. Why do you doubt your husband? What's going on? And that changes the topic of conversation. So observing the precepts requires that you use your discernment. Like the precept against killing. Living in a monastery, you learn a lot about ants. How to keep ants out of your space without killing them. Before observing this precept, I never knew that most ants don't like walking over powder. There are some ants that don't mind walking over powder, but they will not walk over Vaseline. And there are some that will walk over Vaseline, but they will not walk over grease. So you've got a range of ways of keeping them out. Other questions? Okay, passage 30. deals with that question. Sometimes people say, well, I don't have to believe in a life after this to see that all these activities are bad and lead to bad results. And the Buddha says, you know, there's some that say, all who kill living beings experience pain and distress in the here and now. All those who take what is not given, who engage in illicit sex, who tell lies, experience pain and distress in the here and now. However, he says, there is the case where a certain person is seen garlanded and adorned, freshly bathed and groomed with hair and beard, neatly trimmed, enjoying the sensualities of women as if he were a king. They ask about him, my good man, what has this man done that he's been seen, has been garlanded and adorned, etc., as if he were a king? The answer is, my good man, this man attacked the king's enemy and took his life. The king, gratified with him, rewarded him. That is why he is garlanded and adorned as if he were a king. Now there's another case where the man who's an enemy of the king has taken the life of a man or a woman. That's why the kings get, have him seized and inflict punishment on him. So you can't say that everybody who breaks the precepts is going to suffer here and now. There are cases where you, and this particular passage goes on and tells people who were rewarded for stealing something from the enemy of the king, who were rewarded with having sex with the king's enemy, wives. Someone who told a lie as a joke and amused the king, he gets reward. And someone who drinks with the king gets rewarded. So breaking the precepts doesn't automatically lead to suffering in the here and now. It's only when you see things over the larger span of time that you realize that there are negative consequences for sure. Patches 31 takes this even further, points out that there's a case where that you do any of these unskillful forms of behavior that we discussed yesterday, starting with taking life all the way down through holding wrong views with the breakup of the body after death, you reappear in a bad destination. There are other people who do the same things, but after death reappear in a good destination. There are those who abstain from these forms of behavior and go to a good destination, and there are those who abstain from these forms of behavior ended up in the next lifetime going to a bad destination. And the Buddha says, okay, it's because either they performed, those are the cases where, say, you did something that was bad and you end up in a bad destination. Either you, earlier you performed an evil action to be felt as painful, or later you performed, after that you performed an evil action, or at death you adopted and carried out wrong view. Now there's also a case where you may have behaved well, but it turns out that prior to your behaving well, you still have some past bad karma, or you have some bad karma after that, or you develop wrong view afterwards. One of those things would negate the immediate consequences of that good action. So things are not simple. We have lots and lots of actions in our background, and so that the sorting out of those actions at the moment of death depends on a lot of factors. They're quite complex. I mean, one of the things I keep emphasizing throughout the traditions, all the Buddhist traditions I know, is the moment of your mind state at the moment of death. You want to make sure that it's as skillful as possible at that point, because at that point you may be faced with choices. And if you are deluded or confused, it is not expected to be make the right choice. We don't usually think about death as being a choice or offering choices. We say, whoops, there it is, that's it, you're out. At the moment when you're dying, there are things will happen in your mind, and you'll have to choose where you're going to go among the possibilities that show up. And so, depending on your right view or wrong view at the time, you could either avoid some painful past karma, or you could actually take on some negative karma at that point, in spite of some good you've done in the past. So you have to be very careful about trying to do as much good as you can in this lifetime. That'll help put you in a state where your mind state will be positive, where you will be mindful and alert, even up to the point of death. Another one of the series of questions I got in France is, why do we have to sit with pain? I said, well, the pain of meditation is nothing compared to some of the pains that you're going to be experiencing further down the line. So it's good to be able to maintain your mindfulness and alertness even in the face of extreme pain, that you're not taken away, doesn't overcome the mind. Any questions on that passage? Yes, Shirley?
Is there a process for making a wise decision?
okay, you might ask yourself, which options? Give me a range. Are you talking about the moment of death or? Don't do the first thing that comes into your mind when there's a strong emotion. You say, stop and reflect for a bit. This is where having the breath as a technique is useful. That you just breathe calmly for a while. It's okay. If I were to step back from this situation, several questions you could ask. And if I were someone else watching this situation from outside, what would look like the best thing to do? Or further down in my life, I reflected back on today, what do I wish I had said or done? Think of things, kind of try to get a larger perspective before you zoom in and act on in a situation. As long as they're positive, I'd go for it. Any of the above. Whatever seems the best out of the good options you have. But again, like the instructions to Rahula, you have to reflect afterwards. Did that come out well?
Yes. Is choice a perception or fabrication?
Choice is a fabrication. You will be choosing among perceptions and you will be choosing among intentions, but there's a moment of fabrication where you say, I will take this on. Yes? Well, several things can possibly appear at that point. One would be memories of the past. Okay, and if it's a memory of something really unskillful you did, don't dwell on it. Say, okay, that's in the past. I've moved on. I've gone past that now. Other possibilities might come up as places where you could go. And you say, it looks bad. I'm not going to go there. Even if it looks good, ask yourself, you might want to hold in mind the determination, if I have to go someplace, if I want to go to a place where I can continue to practice. And wherever you see that might be a possibility, you go there.
So, the option of drugs that are offered, which kind of take your consciousness out.
Yeah. Well, I would ask for a drug that doesn't take my consciousness out. I mean, they can actually, I understand they have these things where the patients can control their own morphine, and they end up taking a lot less than the nurses tend to shoot them with, because the nurses have to shoot once every 24 hours or once every 12 hours, so they give you a lot more than you need for a while, then the effect wears off. If you have some control over the drip, you tend to take a lot less, and you're a lot more alert. So that if you can get that option. And I know some people who have their death directives, or if they're on their deathbed, they want to be listening to Dharma talks. And I know someone who actually has a CD all prepared that she wants to have played in her room. So that might help, because they say hearing is one of the last senses to go. Okay. I know someone else who played Dharma talks for her husband as he was dying. And they found that the nurses like to come into the room and just kind of sit there. Passage 32 deals with the question of how to deal skillfully with the knowledge that you have done unskillful things in the past. And this is where the Buddha is specifically repeating the belief that all those who take life are destined for hell, all those who steal, all those who indulge in illicit sex, etc., etc., are destined for hell. you hear a teaching like that and you have faith in the teacher, say, oh my God, I've done those bad things and go to hell. And the Buddha says, it's like falling to hell right now. So in this, by implication, the Buddha is not that kind of teacher. Okay. And so this is how the Tathagata teaches, it says, okay. Criticizes and censures the taking of life and says, abstain from taking life. A disciple has faith in that teacher, reflects the Blessed One in a variety of ways, criticizes and censures the taking of life. There are beings that I have killed to a greater or lesser extent. That was not right, that was not good. But if I become remorseful for that reason, that evil of mine will not be undone. So reflecting thus, he abandons right then the taking of life, and in the future refrains from taking life. This is how there comes to be the abandoning of that evil deed. This is how there comes to be the transcending of that evil deed. And then he goes on, when you've dropped any intention to continue with unskillful behavior, then you, devoid of malevolence, unbewildered, alert, mindful, keep pervading the first direction, the east, with awareness and imbued with goodwill. Goes on through the four Brahma Viharas. There's an important connection here, which is that once you have made up your mind to abstain from unskillful behavior, you have to spread goodwill and the other Brahma Viharas to yourself and all beings. You spread them to yourself as a way of giving yourself reassurance that you're doing this, abstaining is for your own good. And you do it for other beings, both especially, say, having goodwill for the beings you have harmed and also for any beings you might potentially harm in the future. Spreading goodwill to yourself is a way of not getting down unnecessarily on your past misdeeds. In this way, you give yourself encouragement, and that strengthens your resolve to refrain from misbehavior in the future. This also shows the connection between goodwill and virtue. In other words, to strengthen your virtue, you develop goodwill, along with the other Brahma Viharas. Just for a second, we can go down the Brahma Viharas. You have goodwill, compassion, empathetic joy, and equanimity. Compassion is basically one form of goodwill. In other words, goodwill is a general wish for happiness. Compassion is specifically goodwill for those who are suffering or are doing things that it would cause suffering. You feel compassion for them. Empathetic joy is for those who are already happy or are doing things that are going to lead to happiness. You feel happy for them. You don't resent them. You're not jealous. You don't try to compete. And finally, equanimity is for the cases where, as I said earlier, people you want to help, but you see that you can't right now, so you have to put the issue aside and then focus on areas where you can be of help. Otherwise, you waste a lot of energy and trying to help people that just can't be helped at that time. Any questions on any of these passages? Remember that passage about the lump of salt? Okay. In other words, you've got some bad deeds in the past, okay. But that's not the end of karma. Okay. it's going to minimize the effects of past bad karma. You know, if you killed a couple people, or if you stole a few things, you know, that's limited. if you engage in genocide, that would be considered unlimited, and even a lot of goodwill is not going to make that go away.
How about Angulo Mall?
There was a limit. 999. That's.
Not the mama,
no. that was done in a limited way.
It's the only thing that is limitless are those kind of boundless states like the Brahma Viharas. Can anything somehow be cured? Is anything else limited?
Or is there anything else unlimited? I think what he's talking to here is that there are some cases where certain deeds are considered going beyond bounds.
Yeah.
Like you kill your mother, you kill your father. That goes beyond bounds. No amount of goodwill is going to erase that one. It's just a few people, but it's important people. So that would be a case of a deed that would not be erased. Mm-hmm. The tradition has it that Moggallana, we know that Moggallana died before the Buddha. He was beaten up several times, and through his psychic powers, he was able to put himself together. And then they came back and they beat him up again. And he realized, okay, I can't do this and more than two or three times. And so he goes and says goodbye to the Buddha. And the commentary comments that it was because he'd killed his parents in a previous lifetime, this was the remainder of that deed that caught up with him. So that would even being an arahant didn't. I mean, his mind didn't suffer, but his body took a real beating. And this was after many aeons of having gone through hell and everything over that. So, move into the section on goodwill. These are the karmic rewards of goodwill. It's an unusual phrase at the beginning. One whose awareness release through goodwill is cultivated. Awareness release is usually a state of concentration. Developed, pursued, given a means of transport, given a grounding. I guess given a means of transport means you're able to send it to all kinds of people. Given in grounding that it's well-founded, steadied, consolidated, while undertaking these 11 benefits can be expected. You sleep easily, you wake easily, you dream no evil dreams. You're dear to human beings, you're dear to non-human beings. Now non-human beings here is usually devas, hungry ghosts, brahmas, those kinds of things. Devas protect you. There's a famous story in the canon where a monk is going down to bathe in a pond, and there's a lotus in the pond. And so he leans over to sniff the lotus, and this deva suddenly appears and says, "You stole the scent of that lotus." And the monk says, "Oh, come on." He says, "There are lots of monks out there who are misbehaving much worse than this." And she says, "Why should I be concerned about them?" And so if you're really serious in the practice, even the slightest fault should appear as big as a cloud. Now think of it, back in those days, what was probably the biggest thing you could imagine. I mean, the sky is big, but there are clouds that cover the sky, so clouds are bigger. So the biggest thing you could imagine. And so the monk suddenly comes to his senses and he says, "Well, then I appreciate what you say. And if you ever see me misbehaving again in the future, please warn me again." And she says, "I'm not your servant. Your behavior is your own lookout." So that's a case of a deva protecting you, warning you about misbehavior. Okay. Neither fire, poison, nor weapons can touch you. Your mind gains concentration quickly. Your complexion is bright. You die unconfused. And if penetrating no higher, you're headed for the Brahma world. Okay, those are the rewards for practicing metta. Now, to go higher than the Brahma world would require the development of discernment. So, any questions about those rewards?
Going to the Brahma world, would that be one stage of awakening, or is that not?
No.
So you come back down,
yeah. Because what you've got the various deva worlds. and they're divided into the realm of sensuality. And those the devas there are just called devas. You get beyond that and you get to the realm of what's called the realm of form, which corresponds to the form jhanas, and the realm of formlessness, which realms of formlessness, which will correspond to the formless jhanas. At that point on, from that point up, you're called brahmas.
Including the formless?
Including the formless. And then in addition to that, you've got the pure abodes, which is where the non-returners go. That's also a Brahma world, but it's a separate category. Pretty high realms, yeah. And you can imagine when people fall from those realms, it hurts. My teacher had a couple students who were extremely difficult people. You could never do enough to please them. And his comment was, they were devas in a previous lifetime, and then fell hard. Kind of like someone who's been living in a palace all the time and suddenly has to go out and live in a village. Only the best people can handle that well. Yes?
In the Buddhist teachings, there's so much to be gained. And so my question is, why did he feel that he needed to have all these other worlds and realms in order to... I think in his teachings, there seems to be much to be learned.
It's good to know in the, kind of in the back of your mind. You know, as I was saying yesterday, suppose you're sitting and meditating and this Brahma comes to you and says, I'm the great Brahma, knower of all, seer of all. What do you want to know? And you would say, I'd like to know what the Buddha taught. In other words, you don't believe everything the great Brahma says. I mean, there are a lot of people whose meditation goes off because they start having visions of beings coming to them, which may actually be beings and it may be hallucinations. But even in a case like that, you can't believe everything they tell you. So it's good to know that even the highest levels, they're still deluded. So, and if you don't have visions like that, you just kind of file it away for future reference, just in case. And if you're about to die and these realms appear to you, and some of them look pretty cool, you know, all the sensual desires you could imagine, you can ask yourself, the good question to keep in mind, is this going to be lead to the end of suffering or not? In which case, maybe the heavenly realms, maybe I don't want to go there, maybe I want to go someplace where it would be better to practice. So just keep that in the back of your mind. I was about to say, and if it actually turns out that you choose a good rebirth, come back and tell me. But then there's a story in the canon about this prince who's been trying to figure out if there's a life after death. And so he goes to some people and says, look, if you're reborn in heaven, please come back and tell me. So the person dies. He said, they don't come back and tell me. And the monkey he's talking to is saying, well, you know, where they live, one day is 100 years. And so they get up there and they say, okay, we'll tell them, but let's enjoy ourselves for a day or two. And then we'll go back and tell them. And by that time, he's gone. So, but it does serve a purpose to know this. As I was saying yesterday about the case of the person who started seeing people coming in his visions. And if you have a sense that it's not just devas and not just angels and demons out there, there are various levels of being. You know, and when people start channeling things and they say, I'm this great whatever spirit or something, okay, they could be just as deluded as you are. You know, the fact that somebody's died doesn't mean they're suddenly wise. So it's good to know in your back of your mind, okay, there are these possibilities out there, but they're not all that reliable. Not necessarily evil, just not reliable. It's good protection.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when you're spreading goodwill, it doesn't mean you have to like them.
Yeah.
So, okay, I mean well to this person, and I know that if I'm sitting here in a conversation, we will probably both start doing unskillful things. Maybe it'd be better to pull out or just to keep a distance. Again, don't think so much in terms of optimal. Just think in terms of what's the right thing for right here, right now. Not necessarily. Some of the deva realms you can also practice. In fact, Ajahn Sawat, the teacher who's founded Bhat Metta, made a comment one time. He says, you know, the human realm is going to get to be a pretty bad place to practice for a while. So I wouldn't come back if I were you. He was saying this to a group of lay people. If you have the choice, go to a deva realm. It's easier to practice there. Yeah, there are better and worse deva realms for this. The worst place to practice probably is the realm of the Gandharvas. If you saw that book, The Buddha Smiles, back there, you met one of the Gandharvas, and he's pretty deluded. Yeah. I mean, sitting there watching the Buddha again awakening, and all I can think about is his lovely lady back home. You know? They're the kind of the teenagers of the deva world. And there's another story. In fact, it's in that same sutta. But it was so long I didn't include it. It's about this woman who has been giving donations to two monks over a long period of time. And all three of them die. And she goes up to be born in the Dusita realm, which is one of the better ones for practicing. The devas there tend to be more mature. And she's looking around, you know, where are the monks that I was taking care of? And she discovers both of them have been reborn as Gandharvas. And so she goes down and she gives them a piece of her mind. You know? Look, I didn't give you all that food so you can come up and play around like little kids, you know. And one of the Gandharvas gets embarrassed and goes off and meditates and then gets to be a higher level. But the other one just couldn't care less. He's off and he's immersed in his pleasures. So it's not the case that all deva realms are bad places to practice. Let's put it that way. Some of them can recall where they're coming from. Some of them can actually come down and listen to Dharma talks if they want to. I mean, some devas have quite a range of things that they can do.
In most humans, you can't recall where we were before and what we were and the specifics of previous lives. Sounds like devas can.
They have more of an ability that way. And you know, you've probably read cases where there was Ian Stevenson, that professor at Virginia, University of Virginia, who, and then there's been another professor who's taken over the chair and is doing more research in this way. And most of the cases where people can remember previous lives is because they were a human being the last time around and a human being this time around. If there's something else that comes in between, it tends to get blocked out. Because a lot of times if it was really negative, your mind just shuts it out. Now, dying from a human realm to be a deva realm is a pleasant experience. And so it's easier to maintain the memory.
Who could infer that people really can't remember what went before? It's chances are it was of a lower realm.
Not necessarily. Some people just don't have the ability. And especially in a culture like ours, there are probably kids who remember these things, but they learn very quickly that they have to forget if they're going to get along with their parents. And even in cultures where they do believe in rebirth, they get freaked out because there's the fear if a child is remembering too much of a previous lifetime is going to die soon. So again, the kids tend to just suppress those memories.
Is there a sign to watch for watchful to see, like, oh, what are these recalling stuff? Like, is there a thing to pay attention to?
Just try to be the kind of parent that the kid feels open with. Because I wouldn't want to push that on a kid. At the same time, if the kid is having those memories, you don't want to suppress them. But if the kid is really getting obsessed with those previous memories, you say, look, that was the last time, this is now. You're a new person.
If he gets obsessed, I'll send him to you.
All the kids you can't handle, come to the monastery. Yes. Yes. You can. Mm-hmm. There are cases of devas listening to Dharma talks and becoming, stream enterers or whatever. Yes. Usually they don't appear. They appear when your eyes are closed, but not necessarily. Sometimes they appear when your eyes are open. I wouldn't know. I mean, they say one of the tests for a deva is if they don't blink. And if I could tell you deva stories for the rest of the afternoon. There was one case, though, when Ginger, one of the women who lives at the monastery, was back in Thailand, and she was staying with one of the ajahns. And he was giving a little kind of Dharma discussion with some of the people at the front of the meditation hall one day. And this woman came up from the back of the hall, extremely gorgeous. I mean, just really stunning. And the way she was dressed was just way over the top. And she sat there for a while, bowed down, and then she left. And after she left, the John turned to his student and said, that was a naga. You know, nagas can appear as human beings. And nagas tend to have flashy tastes. Okay. Passage 34 is the one that I was referring to earlier when the Buddha talks about one of his previous lifetimes. It's who spread after he left his position as king, shaved off his hair and beard, clothed himself in ochre robes, went forth from the home life into homelessness, practiced the four Brahma Viharas, and then after he died, he headed to the Brahma world. And then the Buddha reveals, okay, this was me in a previous lifetime. But this custom did not lead to disenchantment, dispassion, cessation, direct knowing, self-awakening, or unbinding, but only to the attainment of the Brahma world. This is probably one of the clearest statements in the canon that the Brahma Viharas don't take you all the way. Whereas the Eightfold Path does. So that brings us to the Four Noble Dharmas. And it's essentially the fact that even though you try to do your best to work the system to reborn in good places, the system is, because it's complex, is unstable. It can fall apart very easily. And that's your major inducement to want to get out, that you cannot find any state where you have a permanent happiness. It's all going to go up and down, up and down. And it doesn't really go anywhere. It goes down and it goes up, and then it goes up and it goes down. And whereas if you think you had enough of that, then you want to go out. This is what leads to the practice of what's called the karma to end karma. Now, the Buddha identified at the end of passage 34 what that is. It's the Eightfold Path, which is composed of three trainings: virtue, concentration, and discernment. Discernment is right view, right resolve. The virtue is right speech, right action, right livelihood. And concentration is right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Now you take those three trainings, and then you add the release that results, and you've got what are called the Four Noble Dhammas. I'd like to make a few comments on them first before we start going into the readings. First, with virtue. Okay, the virtue here is essentially the same. You observe the precepts as you would from the practice of making merit. But the difference that one of the passages points out is that you, even though you are virtuous, you are not made of virtue. Now, it sounds peculiar, but it has a particular meaning. When you make yourself out of something, that's basically you create a sense of who you are around that activity. And it's, you fashion yourself. And the idea that you want to do is develop is what is called non-fashioning, i.e. you continue practicing virtue, or in the later case when they talk about not fashioning yourself around the practice of jhana, it's not that you stop doing it, it's just the attitude of with which you do it. If you create a self-identity around it, either comparing yourself to other people or taking on the identity of being the meditator or being the virtuous person, okay, you've missed out on an important lesson in discernment. So we noticed earlier that the main difference between practice of merit and the practice of the Four Noble Dhammas is that element of discernment. Now, this doesn't mean there's no discernment in the practice of merit. It's just that the discernment gets taken to a higher level. Reflecting on concentration, it's important here to see the practice of concentration, the practice of mindfulness, all of these things are a type of karma. You actually are doing something. Many times you hear the practice of meditation is just being and not doing. Well, being something is doing. You are making a self around a particular incident. Like if you just be the knowing or just be the oneness. There's a lot of doing that goes into creating that perception, creating that attention, creating all those mental karmas around that particular state that you're trying to create. One of the issues that often comes up is that concentration. How can you create an uncreated or unconditioned state? Well, with the concentration, it is a conditioned state. And it's an activity that you're conditioning and that you use it to get to the unconditioned. There was a book I was reading a while back that said there are basically two approaches to meditation. One is that you have to create awakening, and the other approach is that awakening is already there and you just relax into what's already there. Well, those are not the only two alternatives. They're two bad alternatives, basically. The right alternative is the deathless is already there, but to discover it, you have to put in an effort. The analogy that John Lee gives is salt water. There is fresh water in the salt water, but if you take the salt water and you let it sit, no matter how many years you let it sit, the salt is not going to come out. You've got to distill the water. And that's what the effort of the meditation is. It's a distilling to get the fresh water out of the salt water. Two other things about the idea of being non-reactive. Being non-reactive and just sitting there and taking things with equanimity does not burn up your old karma. Like this idea that just bearing with pain, bearing with the results of your past actions, burns up your old karma. That's one that the Buddha actually ridiculed. Look in the Buddha smiles, and you find that he has some pretty sharp things to say. You know, how much old karma did you burn up today? Even the intention to be non-reactive is itself an action, i.e. it is an intention. So it is creating a new kind of karma. It's a skillful kind of karma, but if you believe that it's going to get you to awakening on its own, that's wrong view. That gets in the way of your awakening. And because it turns out that attachment to non-reactivity has to be abandoned for the sake of what we call non-fashioning, i.e. this, that when you're not creating any sense of self around it at all, because we tend to, many times you're practicing non-reactivity, you tend to identify with that non-reactive state. This is me, this is my true awakened mind, or this is my awakened mind, or whatever. And you have to see, okay, that too has to be taken apart. So we have to see meditation is a kind of doing. In fact, it's a skill. It's an act of learning from your actions. You act to get the mind to stillness, and then you learn, as in the case of Rahula, you learn from your mistakes, what's working, what's not, and gradually you develop skill over time. So this is one of the reasons why this is a kind of karma. It's part of the Eightfold Path, which is the karma, to put an end to karma, but it does involve acting. Were you there when I was teaching the DPP on karma? And do you remember the reaction in the room? Okay. Well, I was teaching karma, and I was saying basically, the question was, how is meditation related to karma? And he says, well, when you're meditating, you're developing a skill. And I was talking about meditating as a skill and went on and on. I was getting more and more blank looks out of the people. And it turned out that a lot of people have been taught that when you meditate, you're not doing anything. And that there is no such thing as a good or a bad meditation. Well, when you're working on a skill, there are days when it succeeds and days when it doesn't, and you have to learn how to treat that with maturity so you can learn from it. So. Another issue that comes up with relationship between meditation and karma is the question of why is it that we focus on the present moment? And the answer is, this is where your intentions are happening. You're here because you want to look at your intentions in action. The Buddha doesn't talk about being in the present very much in the canon. I mean, given all the emphasis that you hear at meditation retreats, you'd think he'd be talking about it all the time. But there are only a few there's a handful of passages in the canon where he does. And in every case, he's saying the reason you want to be carefully attentive to the present is because there's work to be done now, because you could die at any time. So you focus on the present moment, getting as much out of the present moment as you can in terms of understanding what's going on, so that you can do it more and more skillfully. And in every case, he ends up by saying, because you could die tomorrow, and today would have been wasted. Or you're meditating off in the forest, you have to think about, there are dangers, I could die tonight, roving bands of teenagers could come through, all kinds of things could happen. And we were meditating one time on a mesa in Utah. We just arrived, set up our tents, looking at the sunset, getting ready to meditate, and this car drives up 200 yards away, speakers blaring. So we send one of our attendants over to talk to the people. Maybe they could move someplace else. And he came back and he said, well, there's good news and there's bad news. The good news is the kids are really sweet. The bad news is they've invited 200 of their friends for a rave. So, they invited us to the rave, but we declined. Were you there that night? It's not just anything right now, it's alert to what you're doing right now and the results of your actions right now. That's what you want to focus on. It's a very specific part of the present moment that you're wanting to focus on. Okay. Another reason we focus on the present moment relates to that principle of scale and variance. Remember the large picture of karma that you see written out across the universe is actually happening all the time in the present moment. So if you want to understand it, you don't have to go out and search the whole cosmos. You just come and look at the present moment, what you're doing in the mind, how your intentions lead to certain results. And then the way you read those results through your perceptions and your attention will lead to a new intention. You can see that cycle happening right here and now. And this is where keeping in mind that distinction between past karma and present karma gives you your focus. Okay, ideas may be coming up as a result of past karma. Now the question is, what are you going to do with them? That's what the meditation is about. You know, distractions come up, what are you going to do with them? Are you going to go with them, or are you going to learn how to say no? You find yourself in a distraction, what do? Are you going to stay there, or are you going to pull yourself out? You're making these choices all the time, and so you want to be able to see that clearly. Now the fact that the thought has come in, you can write that off as past karma. But what you're doing with a thought, that's what you're responsible for right now. So this is why I say, you know, horrible thoughts come up in your mind, say, oh, my meditation's a mess. You say, no, it's your past karma is a mess. It's what you're doing with the thoughts, your ability to defend them off. That's what you're supposed to be focusing on in the present moment. So seeing this distinction between past and present karma in the present moment allows one to focus on the intention itself. You see, okay, the fact that you are making choices right now, you are free to make certain choices. If your intention were not a creative force for experience, simply intending would not be enough. So intention really is important here. Second, attention is you're asking yourself the right questions. How are you framing your question? A thought comes up, and your usual thought is, does this look like a fun thought to travel with? And if it looks kind of like a fun thought to go with, you go. Or if you have other reasons for telling yourself, if that worrying thought comes up, it may not look fun, but part of you says, I've got to worry about this. If I don't worry about this, I'm going to be in trouble. So you're asking yourself the wrong questions. The right question is this actually a useful thought to follow? Is this a skillful thought to follow? So again, this you're exercising your attention, looking into cause and effect. And then you also, the issues around perception and feeling. When you're practicing concentration, you have to hold a perception in mind and look at the feeling tone that results as a measure, one of the measures of how well you're doing it. So what you're doing is you're focusing on the present moment and you see these present karma things in action. Now other aspects of complex karma, the complexity of karma come into play as well. One of them is the principle of scale and variance. Remember we talked about some of the lessons that come from the practice of merit, which include the fact that you have the proper attitude to the ups and downs in your practice. That, okay, if you're working on developing generosity and you're not seeing the results right away, okay, you just keep at it. When you crash, you don't let yourself get down. You pick yourself up again and move. If you find yourself getting complacent about your practice, you have to be careful about that too. So you learn how to adjust your mind state. Now, having done that in the practice of merit makes it a lot easier to do it in the practice of concentration. You sit here and you're meditating. You're supposed to be meditating and your mind is all over the place. You say, okay, well, this is a bad day. Let's see what we can figure out about it. And not just write it off and say, gee, it's a bad meditation. I better not meditate. No, it's a bad meditation. Let's try to figure out what is a bad meditation like. What does it come from? You might learn something. When the meditation is going well, you don't get complacent. And it's so easy to have a nice meditation and say, oh, this mind state is not going to end. And then you go out and 10 minutes later, it's ended. Okay, you just basically took something, you had something good, and you trashed it. So, okay, get out and try to maintain the meditation state. You walk out, back, get to your car, get back home, see how long you can keep that going. That becomes an inducement to furthering your practice. Then there's also the principle of what I call resonance. How do you get out of these thought worlds? Well, you use your processes of thinking. Remember, the idea of resonance is that you can take a system apart by using the rules of how that system works in a certain way. In this case, we're using the rules of thinking to take thinking apart. Like we talked the other day about looking at the drawbacks of the thinking. There's something that what they call, in one of my friends who's a psychologist, calls poisoning your fantasies. Say there's a fantasy that keeps coming over and over again that you would really like to. Say you've decided you want to be one of those contented devas. And so you think about how great it's going to be a contentive deva, and all you can think about is how nice it is. To poison the fantasy is, what's it going to feel like when you leave? To remind yourself of that. Put some negative element in the fantasy. In other words, you're using thought to pull yourself out of thoughts. And in the course of coming in and going out, you get very used to this process of the mind moving from one world to another world. Because it's in that spot between moving between the other two that you will actually see the potential at some point will open up for choosing neither. But you're going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth over this. So you get to know that territory really well. So that's the point where things get divided by zero when it finally comes apart. So that's some of the ways in which karma relates to the practice of concentration. Four other topics I will just mention briefly, because we don't have much time. We're getting in towards the break. Remember we talked about the Buddha's instructions to Rahula, and we talked at the end about the mental qualities that need to be developed in order to practice that. There is mindfulness. Well, first there's ardency, wanting to behave in a skillful way. Alertness, looking at what you're doing and the action and the results of what you're doing. Mindfulness, remembering the lessons you've learned from the past. And then appropriate attention, which is the right questions that you ask. Those four qualities also go into the practice of mindfulness, the establishing of right mindfulness. You know, the formula is ardent, alert, mindful. You've got those three right there. Appropriate attention is asking the right questions about what's coming up. You know, given that you're looking at things in terms of a particular framework like the five hindrances or the seven factors of awakening, something comes up in your mind, the question is, okay, what do I do with this in light of that frame? That would be appropriate attention. So the practice of right mindfulness relates directly to the teachings on karma in this way, as we saw in the teachings to Rahula. Another point relating to karma and concentration is, if you look at the 16 steps for breath meditation, there's a lot of talk about fabrication. There's bodily fabrication, there's mental fabrication, and learning how to calm these things. That's basically putting insight and tranquility together. Insight is a matter of seeing your experiences as a type of fabrication, and then tranquility is learning how to calm them. So when you're practicing breath meditation in line with those 16 steps, it's bringing insight and tranquility together. Of course, the fabrication side is the karma in the present moment. And then finally, one of the passages we'll be looking at has to do with the person who has attained the first jhana and says, I've got the first jhana, but these other meditators in here don't have the first jhana. And you see that especially in jhana retreats. I had someone come to the monastery after jhana retreat, and after the third day she left. She said, on my retreat I was on the third jhana and I could only hit the first jhana here. And so she left. So that's not a skillful reaction to jhana. The Buddha says, the meditator of integrity sees that even with the practice of jhana, the Buddha says, develop non-fashioning, i.e. don't build an ego around it.